Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There's a curious new twist in the world of bailouts. Forget banks and car companies. It's whole countries now. The European Union said today, yes, fine, it will help Greece with its debt problems. So what, you say? Well, for that, you got to stick around. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 9th of February, and it is great to have you with us. We've been telling you for the past few days about the debt problems a couple of European countries are having, Greece, Spain, Ireland, and Italy as well, and how what's bad over there could eventually wind up being bad over here. It's a little bit, when you think about it, like a fiscal swine flu, in that it's not a question of whether we get infected, but when and how bad it's going to be. Thanks to the world's currency exchanges and the fact that most of Europe is already on a single currency, some of the damage may have already been done. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports now from New York.
When Europe first ditched individual currencies like the Deutschmark and the Spanish peseta for the euro, a lot of investors thought it would be a safe alternative to the dollar. Now, though, with Eurozone countries like Greece and Spain looking a little peaked, investors are getting queasy and they've been rushing to sell their euros. Some European neighbors, like the UK and Switzerland, opted to keep their own currencies. But this latest crisis suggests they're still susceptible to the Eurozone's ills.
They're affected geographically. They're affected by trade ties. They're affected by familiarity.
Mark Chandler's a currency strategist at Brown Brothers Harriman. He says those countries may have separate currencies, but they still move in the euro's orbit.
They tend to move like birds in a flock or a school of fish. They tend to move in the same direction but at different speeds.
But it's not just proximity to the Eurozone that's dragging some of these currencies down. Jos Warsaw's in charge of foreign exchange at Union Bank. He says the UK, for example, has big problems of its own.
Structurally, the UK has some issues that they're working their way through, some big deficits. So I think some investors are a little cautious with the UK.
Investors who are worried about currency contagion have been backing away from the Eurozone and investing in the Japanese yen and the U.S. dollar. But traders like Warsaw say this isn't the end of the euro. Today, Germany said it's working on a plan with the rest of Europe to guarantee debts in countries like Greece and Spain. That could reassure investors and help the euro recover. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
California's biggest for-profit health insurance company has announced a big rate increase. Big, actually, might not even do it justice. Anthem Blue Cross has started telling individual policyholders, that is, folks who buy directly from them, not through their employer, that their premiums are going to jump by as much as 39% beginning March 1st. The company blames higher costs for hospitals, drugs, and doctors. Also, the recession. Anthem says the bad economy is forcing younger, healthier premium payers to leave the insurance pool. And Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports Anthem's heart-stopping rate increase has become part of the healthcare debate in Washington.
Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius shot off a letter asking Anthem to justify its increase. She noted Anthem's parent company, WellPoint, earned $2.7 billion in the fourth quarter of last year. Today, President Barack Obama used Anthem's hike to try to jumpstart health reform negotiations.
If we don't act, this is just a preview of coming attractions. Premiums will continue to rise for folks with insurance. Millions more will lose their coverage altogether. Our deficits will continue to grow larger. And we have an obligation, both parties, to tackle this issue in a serious way.
In a written statement, Anthem said the recession and unemployment are pushing more healthy people to drop insurance, leaving sicker people in the insured pool. Robert Zirkelbach is with America's Health Insurance Plans and Industry Trade Association.
Over the last year, there has been an increase in uncompensated care as more and more people go without health insurance and aren't able to cover their bills if they go to the emergency room.
Health reform would prohibit insurance companies from rejecting customers with pre-existing conditions. But in exchange, the industry wants a mandate to make healthy people buy insurance, says Professor Marjorie Baldwin at Arizona State University.
Otherwise, premiums are going to go up too fast.
As hospitals and doctors seek reimbursement for uncovered health care from their patients who do have insurance. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
This morning, President Obama set up a cabinet-level task force to fight what has been described as an obesity epidemic among American kids. His wife's going to be in charge, and it is going to be a long haul. Nutrition advocates say part of the answer is making healthy food more appealing to the chips and soda crowd. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner explains there is no easy recipe for that one.
Yale University's Jennifer Harris is an expert on kids' food and advertising. She's director of marketing initiatives at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity. Harris says there's a real problem with marketing food that's good for you.
What has been found several times is that if you describe the food as healthy, then people think it doesn't taste as good as foods that are not described as healthy.
Harris says a few years ago, 16 food companies made a pledge to market more nutritional breakfast to children. She says they've slightly lowered the sugar content in cereals, but the stuff marketed to kids is still unhealthy. Marion Nessel, the author of Food Politics, says food companies have no financial incentive to market their healthier products.
The profit is in added value foods, where the ingredients can be bought at a very low cost and stored indefinitely and put into a package with a cartoon on it.
Market researcher Harry Balzer at NPD Group points out that healthy food often costs more than junk food. He says the key is giving Americans healthier versions of foods they already know and love.
Without affecting the taste of the product or without affecting the cost of the product.
And Balzer certainly knows what many Americans know and love. We reached him on his cell phone today doing a little research at a Five Guys Burgers and Fries in Boston. It's one of the fastest growing restaurant chains in the country. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
I need his job. Things were relatively healthy on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For all its recent problems, Toyota did catch a small break today. The threat of another snowstorm in Washington has put congressional business on hold, so the hearing that the House was going to have tomorrow into Toyota's recalls has been put off for a couple of weeks. Still, this is a story that only seems to be growing, no matter how much apologizing the company does. Jeremy Anwyl is the CEO of the auto information site Edmunds.com. Jeremy, good to have you with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Let me ask you the subjective question first, which is, why do you think this particular recall, because it's by no means the first auto recall ever, why has this one risen to such a level?
Well, I think the big issue is that this really goes to the heart of the Toyota brand promise. For years, they've stood for durability, quality, reliability, safety, and now we hear, you know, one thing after the other. And I've got to believe that for many of these owners, they're feeling maybe angry, you know, perhaps even a sense of betrayal.
On that point, though, Toyota engineers and executives, when they make a product and test it and then put it out on the market, they do certain calculations about what I imagine a failure rate would be, how many times a given thing is going to break or go bad. And based on the scale of what we know about this recall, is it safe to say that this is probably within the margin of error of what the company was expecting in terms of problems with any given design?
I think what you're getting at actually is a very important issue. You could say in a broad sense that driving is inherently risky. I mean, there's, 42,000 people that die every year driving a vehicle on America's highways, and most of those deaths had nothing to do with a vehicle fault. But I think the other thing that's happening is that the nature of cars today is that they're getting very complicated, and what's bedeviled Toyota through all this is that the complaints that they're getting are very hard to replicate. So I'm not saying that consumers didn't actually experience something unexpected, but replicating it in a way that is predictable and therefore fixable, if that's the right word, gets to be very, very difficult. Because of that, Toyota's appeared to kind of dither or perhaps not be as open as we would expect in the marketplace. I think the truth of the matter is they just don't really know in many cases what was the problem and therefore how to fix it.
Yeah, I was thinking the other day of you know, how every time you wake up nowadays, it's Toyota has another problem with this and another problem with that, right? And it seems to me that every problem now for them is going to be a huge one because of their track record on handling these.
I think that's true. And I think the risk actually is an industry risk because there's different players here. Obviously, we're talking a lot about Toyota, but there's also a government agency, the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration, that is tasked with sort of monitoring the industry and holding the industry's feet to the fire in the area of safety. And they collect complaints from consumers going back years and years and years. There's about 250,000 complaints on file with that agency for the last 10 model years. And so what's happening now is that they're actually being criticized. So that creates sort of a self-preservation reaction on the part of NHTSA, where they start to investigate these complaints, perhaps where they wouldn't have done otherwise. We could start to see a blizzard of these investigations, and frankly, it's not going to be just Toyota.
So if you're Alan Mulally at Ford or the guys running GM and Chrysler, are you paying really close attention to this?
Yeah, you know, we even saw that last week where Ford announced sort of proactively what they're calling a customer satisfaction program on their Fusion hybrid. We actually have a Fusion hybrid in our fleet. They're not going to like me telling you this, but we took it into the dealer to get the fix, and the dealer paperwork is talking about the recall, but they don't want to call it that, so it's a customer satisfaction program.
What could Toyota have done in retrospect to ameliorate this in some way?
What Toyota needs to recognize is that we are in a new world where every consumer has a megaphone. They can blog about it. You can't deal with the marketplace in a way that might have been appropriate 10 or 15 years ago. You need to be out in the marketplace telling your side of the story. If you don't have the answers, you need to say you don't and explain why you don't. And that's what we haven't seen. We've seen sort of the absence of communication, and the implication is that perhaps they're trying to hide something. And my suspicion is that's not the case, because that's not really going to help anybody. But it seems that way.
Jeremy Anwyl, he's the CEO of Edmunds.com. Jeremy, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Driven in part by a need to fuel its booming economy, China has been expanding its relations overseas. They've gone to Africa in search of oil, South America for minerals and raw goods. And those relationships, they go both ways. Even the small Andean country of Bolivia is strengthening its ties with Beijing. Bolivia is buying Chinese satellites, it's selling mineral rights, and it's importing Chinese-made consumer goods. Imports that are controlled not by big shipping companies, as in many other countries, but by close-knit indigenous families. Annie Murphy has that story.
A few years ago, Nelson Chambi got married. He went to work at his in-laws' textile business in the bustling market city of El Alto. Back then, he traveled to Chile to buy Chinese-made blankets. They were doing pretty well. But then Nelson realized more and more Bolivians were buying direct from China and making bigger profits.
So I said, why don't we cut the chase and go to China? On the bus from Chile, I'd met other passengers who had traveled to Korea, Japan, even China. And I said, it can't be that hard.
Nelson says first, his mother-in-law insisted he have an indigenous holy man read his fortune in coca leaves. His fortune looked good, so Nelson got on a plane to China. A few months later, two shipping containers of blankets arrived in Bolivia.
I was worried, because some people said I was going to get a shipment of rags, but the quality was great.
Nelson made $25,000 on the shipment, no small sum in a place where the average income is just over $100 a month. The potential for new business and higher earnings has prompted many Bolivian merchants to travel to China, and they're looking for extra skills to help them negotiate. Maisin Chen teaches Chinese at the RGA Language Academy in La Paz. Just a few years ago, there was no demand for her services.
Now I'm teaching 8 classes with a total of 50 or 60 students. Most of them are merchants who want to do business in China. They want to be able to communicate directly with factory owners to get a better price.
Aldo Feldin is one of those students. He's dressed in a tracksuit and blushes a lot. He doesn't look like a powerful businessman. His family imports fabric for polleras, layered skirts worn by local indigenous Aymara women, and their business is one of the biggest in La Paz. Aldo often travels to countries like Egypt, Korea, and China. Aldo says the first time he went to China, he couldn't communicate at all and managed to buy several containers worth of goods using only a calculator. For his next business trip in April, Aldo hopes to buy even more products with the skills he picked up in class. According to Nelson Chambi, the merchant importing blankets, this entrepreneurial spirit has a lot to do with history.
Our people, the Aymara, often don't have the power of education or professional training, so the majority go into the business of trade. Our grandfathers and grandmothers have always come to La Paz to sell products like potatoes and onions.
And it turns out, for these indigenous merchants, the leap from selling onions in the capital to buying boatloads of textiles in China isn't that big. In La Paz, Bolivia, this is Annie Murphy for Marketplace.
Coming up, antitrust and insurance.
If you can make a case somehow that it benefited consumers and drove down premiums and rates, then maybe you could justify it.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 150 points today. That's 1.5%, ended at 10,058. NASDAQ piled on 24 points, 1.1%, finished at 2150. The S&P 500 lifted 13 points, 1.3%, closed at 1,070. Part of the fallout from that Euro story that we were telling you about included a dip in the dollar and a gain in the price of commodities. Shares of Chevron bubbled up 1.75% today. ExxonMobil overflowed 1.33%. Morgan Stanley raised its rating on the industrial sector today. That helped Caterpillar climb more than 5%. United Airlines reported revenue in January that blasted past analyst estimates. Stock in UAL, its parent company, rocketed up more than 17%. Today. The price on the 10-year T-note fell. That pushed the yield up to 3.64%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. And by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at MassMutual.com/mutuality. Give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Wednesday. The Commerce Department is scheduled to report on international trade for the month of December. In Washington, a lot of hearings and other events are postponed or canceled due to the incoming massive snowstorm. And we met the character Willie Loman on February 10th, 1949, with the premiere of Death of a Salesman in New York. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Obama made an unannounced appearance in the White House press room today. He went back and forth with reporters for, I'd say, a bit less than an hour. Question number one was health care and whether the president, as some Republican leaders have suggested, would be willing to scrap what has been done so far and start all over from nothing. Mr. Obama gave that a qualified yes, but sometime in the next few weeks, House Democrats are set to vote on a bill that could alter the fundamentals of the health care debate by stripping health insurance companies of their exemption from federal antitrust laws. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports now from Washington that what starts with health insurance may not stop there.
In 1869, yes, 1869, the Supreme Court decided that insurance companies were exempt from federal antitrust laws. Congress passed legislation along the same lines in the 1940s, Why? Insurance wasn't considered commerce. It isn't a product you can hold in your hand. Critics say the exemption has made it easier for unscrupulous insurers to fix prices and agree to stay out of each other's markets. Congressman Peter DeFazio, an Oregon Democrat, says research shows the exemption hurts consumers.
If you can make a case somehow that it benefited consumers and drove down premiums and rates, then maybe you could justify it. But like I say, the Consumers Union has estimated that it's an unnecessary and additional $40 billion on our premiums a year.
The exemption allows insurers to do things other businesses can't, like pool information on, say, losses on claims from 35-year-old drivers. That's where things can get murky. Kenneth Abraham teaches law at the University of Virginia. He says insurers could use that information to make predictions, which they would all use to set premiums.
The losses are projected into the future, and that practice might violate the antitrust laws.
Abraham says that could amount to price fixing, because predicting future losses is at the heart of setting a premium. Craig Barrington was a lawyer for the American Insurance Association for almost 20 years and is now in private practice. He says insurance companies still have to comply with state antitrust laws, and they're strong enough to prevent price fixing.
Any effort by two insurers to go out to some bar and grill somewhere and sit down and agree on prices would be a violation of state law and would be prosecuted by the states.
Barrington says the states can also prevent insurers from carving up markets. But Senator Patrick Leahy, a Vermont Democrat, says state antitrust laws are very difficult to enforce.
Most states have a small attorney general's office, and they don't have the ability to do that. Whereas the Department of Justice has highly professional people, and they have the ability to look into these things.
These arguments have ping-ponged across Capitol Hill for years. Congress has tried to repeal insurers' antitrust exemption several times since the 1980s. This latest effort in the House would only apply to health insurers. They don't compete like, say, car insurers do. They've consolidated. The thinking is there would be more competition if the federal antitrust exemption were lifted. Congressman DeFazio says that would make it easier to subject all insurers to federal antitrust law.
But if we can succeed in health insurance, then I think that would open up the floodgates for the other kinds of insurance that are out there and blow away their arguments that somehow this is going to be detrimental to consumers.
But the House bill on health insurers faces long odds in the Senate. History will probably repeat itself. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
In New Orleans today, there's a parade the city has been waiting almost 50 years for. Organizers say they'll use Mardi Gras floats to carry Saints players and their Super Bowl trophy around town. The team has come a long way from the days when fans used to put paper bags over their heads and call the team the Aints. Commentator John Wertheim says the city has come a long way, too, and from way farther down.
As a native of Indiana, I suppose I had a rooting interest in last Sunday's Super Bowl. But even after the Colts lost to the Saints, I didn't feel much sting. If any community could use some good mojo, I figured, it was New Orleans. The Saints all but hijacked the NFL playoffs. While some of that was surely owed to their excellent quarterback, fearless coach, and Cajun expressions, it was mostly a function of provenance. How do you not root for a team hailing from a beleaguered city ravaged by natural disaster? In fact, the Las Vegas line was about the only place where the Colts were favored. CBS certainly didn't sidestep what media critics called the Katrina angle. The pregame narrative was focused largely on the Saints and what their win, quote, would mean for the city. A few hours before kickoff, the network televised Wynton Marsalis performing a moving musical tribute to the Crescent City. It culminated when Katie Couric interviewed Saints quarterback Drew Brees and asked, "Did you help save New Orleans, or did New Orleans help save you?" No doubt the network executives were onto something. Despite featuring teams from two of the smallest NFL markets, Super Bowl 44 was the most watched program in television history, drawing an average of 106.5 million viewers. For perspective, the previous record was held by the 1983 series finale of MASH. Clearly to many, this game was about much more than football. It's easy, of course, to be cynical and wonder how deeply a successful football team helps the people of the Ninth Ward, or how far Super Bowl glory goes in attracting industry and investment to a city that continues to lose population, where estimates for rebuilding are still in the billions. But there was something poignant about this nationwide support of the Saints. Collectively, it was a way of saying, we're with you. The Dallas Cowboys have long laid claim to being America's team, but that distinction's now being challenged by the franchise one state over. In one sense, this is more than a fleeting crush. Thanks to, quote, the Katrina angle, the Saints are likely to be the NFL's darling next season as well. The only threat? If the Detroit Lions get better in a hurry.
John Wertheim is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. You can send us your thoughts about football or the Lions or anything else you like. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it has come to this. American Airlines says economy class passengers on its domestic flights are going to have to pay to stay warm. Starting May 1st, just in time for the summer rush, a pillow and blanket set will be available for $8. So how many more formerly free luxuries do you suppose airlines can possibly charge for? The marketplace players say, oh, lots more.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is your captain speaking. We've reached our cruising altitude. Just want to give you a quick rundown of the amenities available for purchase on this flight. In a few minutes, we'll be cutting off the supply of oxygen in the economy cabin. Additional oxygen can be purchased for a nickel per minute. Just slip your coins into the slot in the armrest. Exact change is required. If you need change, our attendants will provide it to you for an additional fee of $1 per nickel. In about an hour, we'll be flying over the Grand Canyon, and you can take a look by inserting a $5 bill in the slot beside your window. The window shade will pop up for exactly 23 seconds. $30 to use the restroom, $10 a flush, and when you get back to your seat, our attendants will be happy to recline it for you for $57. Or for $5, they'll punch you in the head so hard you black out for the whole flight. That's about it. Now just sit back, relax, and enjoy the next 2 hours. At that point, passengers who refuse to pay our $200 completion fee will be thrown off the plane 36,000 feet above Wichita, while the rest of us continue on to New York. Thanks again for traveling with us. We know you have a lot of choices when flying, and they're all bad, so shut up.
Our own Rico Galliano wrote, produced, directed, and starred for the Marketplace Players today.
Marketplace is supported by PBS, presenting Faces of America, with Henry Louis Gates Jr., Meryl Streep, and Stephen Colbert, who dig into their family trees Wednesday at 8, 7 Central on PBS. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note before we go today, courtesy of the San Francisco Chronicle. Northern California, as you may know, prides itself on being more environmentally aware than much of the rest of the country. Sadly, that has helped lead to a deficit in Berkeley. The city's budget is $10 million in the red, mostly because of a decline in something called refuse revenue. Too many people are recycling too much of their waste to support the Department of Public Works business model, it seems. That's the economics of garbage for you right here on Marketplace. It's from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 150 points, 1.5%. The NASDAQ gained 24 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 added 13 points. That is 1.3%. Thanks today to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. The Morning Report is where you tune in the morning for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on our program is Washington, D.C., the new hotspot for jobs.
If companies aren't necessarily relocating here right now, they are for sure putting their hooks a little bit deeper, putting some more people here.
Unless, of course, it snows. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.